elevation on the south flank of the Gropera. By the time he'd neared the bottom, the sun had risen and was shining on the peak of Pizzo Stella ahead and to his right. The air smelled so fragrant there with pine and balsam that it was hard for him to recall the rank scent of bombs. Pino stopped there, drank water, and ate half of the ham, cheese, and bread Bormio had packed for him. He stretched a bit, looking off, and thinking about Father Ray's warning to try to stay out of sight of people who thought they owned the pass. What was that about? Shouldering his pack once more, Pino started up the switchback trail that led to the Passo Angeloga, the Angel's Step, the southern pass toward Val di Lei. Until that point, he had been cutting down a long side hill. Now he was ascending almost constantly, taking big lungfuls of thin air while his calves and thighs burned. The trail soon left the forest, and trees dwindled to a few scraggly, wind-gnarled juniper bushes that clung to rocky outcroppings. The sun broke over the ridge, revealing other ground shrubs, mosses, and lichen, all muted oranges, reds, and yellows. 3/4 of the way up to the pass, clouds started to scud across the sky, hanging up on the pinnacle of the Gropera, far above Pino and to his left. The tundra-like terrain gave way to rock and scree fields well below the saddle. Though there was still a solid trail, loose rocks slid beneath his new boots, the stiff leather of which began to rub at his heels and toes. His plan had been to reach the stacked rock cairn at the middle of the Angel's Step and remove his shoes and socks. But 3 hours into his hike, the clouds grew large, ominous, and gray. The wind picked up. To the west, he could see the slanting charcoal lines of a storm. 2. Putting on the anorak, Pino pressed on toward the cairn at the crossing of several trails at the top of Passo Angeloga, including one that led toward the shoulder of the Gropera and another toward Pizzo Stella. Fog came swirling in before he reached the stack of rocks. The rain followed, a few drops at first, but Pino had been in the Alps often enough to sense what was coming. Ditching any idea of checking his feet or having something to eat, he touched the cairn and pivoted into the wind and the building storm. The rain quickly turned to marble-sized hail that battered at his hood and caused him to throw up his forearm to protect his eyes as he dropped back down the mountain. Hail burst against the rocks and loose stone on the trail, glazing them and forcing Pino to move slower. The hail died with the wind, but the rain kept on in a steady downpour. The trail became an icy sluice box. It took Pino more than an hour to reach the first trees. He was soaked. He was chilled. His feet had blistered. When he reached where the trail split and climbed back toward Motta and Casa Alpina, he heard shouting from ahead and down toward Soste. Even at a distance, even through the rain, he could tell that the voice was a man's and that he was angry. Pino remembered Father Ray's warning about being seen and felt his heart race as he turned and ran. Hearing the man's cries turn to outrage behind and below him, Pino sped on the uphill trail into the trees and didn't slow for almost 15 minutes. His lungs felt like they'd burst. He stood hunched over, gulping for air and feeling nauseated from the exertion and the altitude. But he no longer heard shouting, just the rain dripping from the trees and, somewhere far below, a faint train whistle. As he pressed on, he felt good and laughed at having eluded the man. The rain was starting to let up when Pino reached Casa Alpina. He'd been gone 5 hours and 15 minutes.
"What took you so long?" Father Ray asked, appearing in the front hallway. "I had faith, but Brother Bormio was starting to get worried."
"Hail," Pino said, shivering.
"Strip to your underwear and go by the fire," Father Ray said. "I'll send Mimo to fetch you some dry clothes."
Pino took off his boots and socks, grimaced at the nasty blisters, all of which had popped and were a livid red.
We'll put iodine and salt on those, Father Ray said.
Pino cringed. When he was down to his undershorts, he chattered, hugged his chest, and hobbled into the dining hall where all 40 boys were quietly studying under the watchful eye of Brother Bormio. The second they saw mostly naked Pino doing his awkward, exaggerated walk toward the fireplace, they broke into howls of laughter, with Mimo laughing hardest of all. Even Brother Bormio seemed to find it funny. Pino waved them off, didn't care, just wanted to be as close as he could get to that fire. He stood on the warm hearth for several long minutes, shifting his body one way and then another, until Mimo arrived with dry clothes. When Pino had dressed, Father Ray came over with a mug of hot tea and a bowl filled with warm salt water for his feet. Pino drank the tea thankfully, and had to grit his teeth when he plunged his feet into the salt water. The priest asked Pino for a complete rundown of the morning's exercise. He told Father Ray all about it, including his encounter with the angry man from Soste.
You didn't get a look at his face?
He was kind of far, and it was raining, Pino said. Father Ray thought about that.
After lunch, you can take a nap, and then you owe me 3 hours of studying.
Pino yawned and nodded. He ate like the proverbial horse, limped down to his bunk, and passed out cold the moment his head hit the pillow. 3. The following morning, Father Ray shook him awake an hour later than he had the previous day.
Get up, he said. You have another climb ahead of you. Breakfast in 5 minutes.
Pino moved, felt sore everywhere, but his blisters were better for the salt bath. Still, he dressed as if he were in a fog as thick as the one he'd encountered the day before. He was a growing teenage boy. He liked to sleep a lot and couldn't stop yawning as he gingerly made his way in stocking feet back to the dining hall. Father Ray was waiting with food and a topographical map.
I want you to flank to the north today, Father Ray said, tapping the wide lines that defined the bench at Mota, including the cart track that dropped down the mountain to Madesimo, and then a series of tight lines indicating increasing steepness beyond it. Stay high crossing the face here and here. You'll find game trails that will help you cross this ravine. And eventually you'll end up over here in this meadow, up the slope from Madesimo. Would you recognize it?
Pino stared at the map.
I think so, but why don't I avoid that face, drop down to Madesimo on the 2-track, and then climb straight up to that spot? It would be faster.
It would be, Father Ray said.
But I'm not interested in your speed, just that you can find your way and not be seen.
Why?
I have my reasons, which I'll keep to myself for now, Pino. It's safer that way.
That only deepened Pino's confusion, but he said,
Okay. And then back?
No, the priest said.
I want you to climb into the bowl of the North Cirque. Look for the game trail that goes up and over into Val d'Ilay. Don't climb it unless you feel you're ready. You can come back and try another day.
Pino sighed, knowing he was in for another rough hike. Weather wasn't a factor. It was a beautiful late September morning in the Southern Alps. But Pino's muscles and taped blisters nagged at him as he maneuvered across rocky catwalks on the western face of the Gropera and through a ravine choked with old logs and avalanche debris. It took him more than 2 hours to reach the meadow Father Ray had shown him on the map. He started uphill through deep alpine grasses, already turned paler than brown.
Like Anna's hair, Pino thought, examining the hairs that surrounded the seed pods, mature and ready to spread on the wind.
He remembered Anna on the sidewalk beyond the bakery, and how he'd rushed to keep up with her. Her hair was just like this, he decided, only riper, lusher. As he climbed on, the soft stalks of grass sliding across his bare legs made him smile. 90 minutes later, he reached the North Cirque. It looked like the interior of a volcano, with 300-meter sheer walls to his left and right, and ragged, sharp stone teeth along the top. Pino found the goat trail and thought about climbing it, but decided he wouldn't be worth a damn up there, with his feet feeling like ground meat. Instead, he dropped straight downhill to Madesimo. He reached the village at 1 o'clock that Friday afternoon and went to the inn, ate, and reserved a room. The innkeepers were kind people, with 3 children, including 7-year-old Nico.
"I'm a skier," Nico boasted to Pino, while he wolfed down his food.
"I am too," Pino said.
"Not as good as me,"
Pino grinned. "Probably not."
"I'll take you skiing when it snows," the boy said. "Show you."
"I look forward to that," Pino said, and tousled Nico's hair. Stiff, but no longer ravenous, Pino went in search of Alberto Ascari, but the engine repair shop wasn't open. He left a note telling Ascari of his plan to return in the evening and hiked back to Casa Alpina. Father Ray listened closely to Pino's description of crossing the cliffy face of the Gropera and his decision not to climb the North Cirque. The priest nodded.
"You don't want to be in the rocks if you're not ready for them. You will be soon enough."
"Father, after I'm done studying, I'm going to go down to Madesimo to spend the night and see my friend Alberto Ascari," Pino said.
When Father Ray squinted, Pino reminded him that weekends were his own.
"I did say that," the priest said. "Go, have fun and rest up, but be ready to start again Monday morning."
Pino took a nap and then studied ancient history and math before reading the play The Giants on the Mountain by Luigi Pirandello. It was past 5 when he started back down the trail to Madesimo in his street shoes. His feet were killing him, but he hobbled all the way to the inn, checked in, spent time regaling little Nico with his ski racing stories, and then went to Ascari's uncle's house. Alberto opened the door, welcomed him, and insisted he come in for dinner. His aunt was a better cook than Brother Bormio, which was saying something. Ascari's uncle loved to talk about cars, so they got on famously. Pino gorged himself to the point where he almost fell asleep during dessert. Ascari and his uncle helped him back to the hotel, where Pino kicked off his shoes, flopped on the bed, and slept in his clothes. 4. His friend knocked on his door right after dawn.
"Why are you up so early?" Pino asked, yawning.
"I was going to..." "You want to learn to drive or not? The next 2 days are supposed to be clear, no rain, no snow, so I'm willing to teach you. You pay for petrol, though."
Pino scrambled for his shoes. They ate a quick breakfast in the hotel dining room and then went out to Ascari's Fiat. For the next 4 hours, they drove above Campo Dolcino on the road to the Splugen Pass and Switzerland. On that winding route, Alberto taught Pino how to read the gauges and use them, and how to adapt to terrain, elevation, and direction changes. He showed Pino how to drift through some turns and to knife through others, and how to use the engine and the gears rather than the brakes to keep the car under control. They drove north until they could see German checkpoints and the Swiss border beyond, and turned around. On the way to Campo Dolcino, 2 Nazi patrols stopped them, demanding to know what they were doing on the road.
"I'm teaching him to drive," Ascari said, after they'd turned over their papers.
The Germans didn't seem happy about it, but waved them on. When they returned to the hotel, Pino was as excited as he'd been in a long time. What a thrill it was to drive a car like that. What an amazing gift he'd been given to learn from Alberto Ascari, the future European champion. Pino again ate dinner at the Ascari's and enjoyed listening to Alberto and his uncle talk about auto mechanics. They went to the shop after dinner and tinkered with Alberto's Fiat until almost midnight. The next morning, after early mass, they set out again for the road between Campo Dolcino and the Swiss border. Ascari showed Pino how to use crests in the road to his advantage, and to look far ahead whenever he could, so his brain was already plotting how best to run the car for optimum speed. On his last run down the pass, Pino took them around a blind corner going too fast, and almost crashed into a German jeep-style vehicle called a Kübelwagen. Both cars swerved and narrowly avoided collision. Ascari looked back.
"They're turning around," Alberto said. "Go!"
"Shouldn't we stop? You wanted a race, didn't you?" Pino floored it. Ascari's car had a better engine and was far more nimble than the army vehicle, and the Nazis were out of sight before they left the town of Isola.
"God, that was great," Pino said, his heart still slamming in his chest.
"Wasn't it?" Ascari said, and laughed. "You didn't do too bad." To Pino it was high praise, and he felt wonderful leaving for Casa Alpina, having promised to return the following Friday to continue the lessons. The hike back to Mota was far less painful than it had been coming down 2 days before.
"Good," Father Ray said, when he showed him the calluses building on his feet.
The priest was also interested in his tales of learning to drive.
"How many patrols did you see on the Splugen Pass Road?"
"Three," Pino said.
"But you were only stopped by two?"
"The third tried to stop us, but couldn't catch me in Alberto's car."
"Don't provoke them, Pino. The Germans, I mean."
"Father, I want you to practice being unnoticed," Father Ray said. "Driving a car like that gets you noticed, brings you to the Germans' attention. Understand?" Pino didn't understand, not completely anyway, but he could see the concern in the priest's eyes and promised not to do it again. The following morning, Father Ray shook Pino awake long before dawn.
"Another clear day," he said. "Good for a climb."
Pino groaned, but he got dressed and found the priest and breakfast waiting in the dining hall. On the topographical map, Father Ray pointed to a razorback ridge that started a few hundred vertical meters directly above Casa Alpina and made a long, steep, and serpentine climb all the way to the peak of the Gropera.
"Can you do it alone, or do you need someone to guide you?"
"I've been up it once," Pino said. "The really hard parts are here, here, and then that chimney, and the thin spot up top."
"If you get to the chimney and don't think you're up to it yet, don't go farther," Father Ray said. "Just turn around and climb back down. And take a walking staff. There are several in the shed. Have faith in God, Pino, and stay alert."
Chapter 7 1. Pino set out at dawn, hiking straight up the Gropera. Glad for the staff, he used it crossing a narrow stream before he flanked to the southeast toward that razorback ridge. Busted sheets of rock sheared off the mountain over thousands of years made the bowl chaotic terrain, and the going was slow until he reached the tail of the mountain spine. There would be no defined trail from here on up. Just rock and the occasional grass tuft or tenacious bush. Given the cliffs that fell away on both sides of the spine, Pino knew he couldn't afford a mistake. The one time he'd been on the ridge, 2 years ago, he'd been with four other boys and a guide friend of Father Ray's from Madesimo. Pino tried to remember how they'd gone up a series of broken staircases and treacherous catwalks that climbed to the base of the spire high above him. He felt a few moments of doubt and fear at the idea he might take the wrong route, but then forced himself to calm down and trust his instincts, handle each section as it came, and then reevaluate his route as he ascended. Getting up onto the actual spine was his first challenge, A wind-smoothed and rounded column of stone, about 2 meters high, defined the very base of the ridge and seemed unclimbable. But on the south side, the rocks were cracked and fragmented. Pino tossed up his staff, heard it clatter to a stop. He jammed his fingers and the toes of his boots into cracks and onto narrow bits of ledge and went up after the staff. A few moments later, he knelt on the razorback, his lungs heaving. He waited until they'd calmed, took the staff, and got to his feet. Pino began to pick his way higher, finding a rhythm to each footfall, reading the jigsaw terrain before him, and looking for the path of least resistance. An hour later, he faced another major challenge. Slabs of stone had broken away eons before, leaving the way up blocked, except for a jagged gouge in the rock face. It was less than a meter wide and again as deep, and it climbed like a crooked chimney from the base up nearly 8 meters to a ledge. Pino stood there for several minutes, feeling the fear in him build again. But before it could freeze him, he heard Father Ray's voice telling him to have faith and to stay alert. At last, he pivoted 180 degrees and fit himself into the crack in the cliff. He pressed out his hands and levered his boots against the walls of the chimney. He was able to maneuver now, and climbed with 3 points of contact supporting the moving fourth point, a hand, a foot, as it groped and probed for higher ground. 6 meters up, he heard a hawk calling, and looked out from the crack and down the ridge toward Mota. He was dizzyingly high up the mountain now, felt a rush of vertigo, and almost lost his grip on the rock. That scared him half to death. He couldn't fall. He couldn't live through a fall. Have faith. That thought was enough to drive Pino up the chimney and onto the ledge, where he gasped with relief and thanked God for helping him. When his strength returned, he made his way to the southwestern ridge with little pause. The ridge was sheer and razorback, barely a meter wide in places. Avalanche chutes plunged to either side of the jagged way forward to the base of the Gropera's craggy spire, which was more than 40 meters tall and shaped like a crooked spearhead. Pino didn't give the dagger-like crag a second glance. He was straining to spot where the various shoulders and clavicles of the mountain came together below the base of the spire. He found what he was looking for, and his heart began to slam in his chest again. He closed his eyes, told himself to calm down, and to believe. Making the sign of the cross, he went on, feeling like a tightrope artist as he passed between the 2 main avalanche chutes, not daring to look left or right down them, fixed on creeping straight ahead to where the catwalk widened. When he reached the end of the catwalk, Pino hugged the stone blocks jutting from the wall like they were long-lost friends. When he was sure he could go on, he climbed up the blocks, which were irregular, almost like a stack of bricks that had tipped over, but stable, unmoving, and he was able to climb higher with relative ease. 4.5 hours after he left Casa Alpina, Pino reached the base of the crag. He peered to his right and saw a steel cable anchored into the rock and stretched horizontally around the spire at chest height, above a ledge perhaps 18 centimeters wide. Feeling queasy at what he had to do now, Pino took several deep breaths to shake off his growing jitters before reaching out and grabbing the slack cable. The toe of his right boot probed for and then found the narrow outcropping. It was almost like being on the ledge outside his bathroom window at home. Once he thought about it that way, he was able to hold tight to the cable and scuttle around the base of the crag. 5 minutes later, Pino reached the top of the broadest ridge on the mountain, south-southeast facing, wide, and covered with amber hummocks of lichen, ground moss, edelweiss, and alpine aster. He lay on his back, gasping with the noontime sun beating down on him. The ascent had felt completely different from the time he'd been guided up by a man who'd done the routine 30 times, showing him each hand and foothold. This climb had been the greatest physical challenge of his life. He'd had to think constantly, evaluate constantly, and rely on faith, which he realized was tiring, not easy to sustain at all. Pino guzzled water, thinking, "But I did it. I made it up the hard way, on my own." Happy, more confident, he gave thanks for his day and for his food, and then wolfed down the sandwich Brother Bormio had packed for him. Delighted to find more strudel, he ate slowly, savoring each bite. Had there ever been anything that tasted that good? Pino felt drowsy and lay back, closing his eyes and feeling like everything in that timeless place of mountain and sky was as it should be. 2. Mist woke him. Pino checked his watch, surprised to see it was nearly 2 in the afternoon. Clouds had rolled in. He could see no more than 90 meters down the slope now. With the anorak on, Pino used game and shepherd trails to skirt to his east and north. An hour later, he came to the rim on the back side of the Gropera's north cirque. It took him a few tries before he found a path that traversed down the steep interior of the bowl and then zigzagged to the point where he'd turned around 3 days before. He stopped and looked back up what he'd just come down. After the challenges he'd faced earlier in the day, it hadn't seemed that bad at all. But by the time Pino had trudged down the mountain to Madesimo and then back up to Molta, he was exhausted. Light was dwindling when he reached Casa Alpina. Father Ray was waiting in the hall off the dining area where the boys were studying, and the air was filled with the sumptuous odor of Brother Bormio's newest creation. "You're late," Father Ray said. "I didn't want you out there at night." "I didn't want to be coming off the mountain in the dark either, but it's a long way, Father," he said. "And the climb, it was more difficult than I remembered."
"But you have faith you could do it again?" the priest asked.
Pino thought about the chimney, the catwalk between the avalanche chutes, and the cable traverse. He didn't exactly want to do any of them again, but he said, "Yes."
"Good," Father Ray said. "Very good."
"Father, why am I doing this?" The priest studied him and then said,
"I'm trying to make you strong. You may need to be in the months ahead."
Pino wanted to ask him why, but Father Ray had already turned away. 2 days later, the priest sent Pino on the Angel Step route to Val d'Ilay. The day after that, Pino worked the traverse route to the North Cirque and climbed the goat trail almost to the rim. On the 3rd day, he took the hard way up, but he had so much more confidence he cut an hour off the time it took him to reach the avalanche chutes. The weather held through the following weekend, and through 2 more days of driving lessons. Remembering Father Ray's warning, he and Ascari stayed off the Splugen Pass road and practiced on the switchbacks around Madesimo. On Sunday afternoon, they picked up 2 girls whom Ascari knew in Campo Dolcino. One was Ascari's friend, Titiana, and the other was Titiana's friend, Frederica. She was dreadfully shy and would hardly look at Pino, who wanted to like her, but he kept thinking of Anna. He knew it was crazy to think about her at all. He'd talked to her all of 3 minutes and hadn't seen her in almost 4 months, and she'd stood him up. And yet he had faith he'd see Anna again. She'd become this fantasy he clung to, a story he told himself whenever he was lonely or uncertain about his future. When Pino reached Casa Alpina after another 3 days of hard climbing in the 1st week of October 1943, he was exhausted and ravenous, He ate two bowls of spaghetti bormio and drank several liters of water before he could lift his head and look around the dining room. The usual boys were all there. Mimo was commanding an entire table of them on the other side of the room, and Father Ray was entertaining guests, two men and a woman. The younger man had sandy hair. His arm was around the shoulder of the woman, who had pale skin and dark, preoccupied eyes. The older man wore a suit, no tie, had a mustache, and smoked. He coughed a lot, and his fingers softly drummed on the tabletop whenever the priest talked. Pino sleepily wondered who they were. It wasn't that unusual for visitors to come to Casa Alpina. Parents often visited, and many hikers sought refuge there during storms. But these three were no hikers. They were dressed in street clothes. Pino desperately wanted to go to bed, but he knew that wouldn't go over well with Father Ray. He was trying to get up the energy to study when the priest came over and said, "You've earned a day's rest tomorrow, and you can put off studying until then, okay?" Pino smiled and nodded. He couldn't remember how he managed to find and get into his bunk. 3. When he finally awoke, it was broad daylight, and the sun shone in the window at the end of the hall. Mimo was gone. So were all the other boys. When he entered the dining room, it was empty, except for those three visitors, who were having a heated, whispered discussion at the other end of the room. "We can't wait any longer," the younger man was saying. "It's all disintegrating. 50 in Mena. They're raiding Rome even as we speak." "But you said we were safe," the woman fretted. "We are safe here," he said. "Father Ray is a good man."
"But for how long?" the older man said, lighting another cigarette.
The woman noticed Pino looking their way and silenced the men. Brother Bormio brought Pino coffee and bread and salami. The visitors left the room, and he didn't think much about them the rest of the day, which he spent by the fire with his books. By the time Mimo and the boys trooped in from a long hike, it was almost dinner time, and Pino was feeling not only rested, but as fit as he'd been in his entire life. As much as he was exercising, with the massive amounts of food Brother Bormio was feeding him, Pino felt like he was gaining weight and muscle every day.
"Pino," Father Ray said, as Mimo and two other boys laid out plates and silverware on the long table. Pino set his books aside and got up out of his chair.
"Father? Find me after dessert in the chapel."
That puzzled Pino. The chapel was rarely used for anything besides a small Sunday service, usually at dawn. But he left his curiosity aside and sat and joked with Mimo and the other boys, and then entranced them with his description of the perils of the hard way up the Gropera. "One wrong step up there and it's over," he said.
"I could do it," Mimo boasted.
"Start doing pull-ups, push-ups, and squats. I'll bet you can."
The challenge ignited Mimo, as all challenges did, and Pino knew his brother was about to become a pull-ups, push-ups, and squats fanatic. After dishes had been cleared, Mimo asked Pino if he wanted to play cards. Pino begged off, saying he was going to the chapel to talk to Father Ray.
"About what?" Mimo said.
"I'll find out," Pino said, grabbing a wool hat from the rack near the front door.
He put it on and went out into the night. 4. The temperature had fallen below freezing. Above him, a quarter moon shone, and the stars looked as brilliant as firecrackers. A north wind bit his cheeks with the first hint of winter as he walked toward the chapel, beyond which a grove of towering fir trees grew along the rim of the plateau. 4 candles burned when he thumbed the latch to the chapel door and went inside. Father Ray was on his knees in a pew, praying, head down. Pino shut the chapel door quietly and sat. After several moments, the priest made the sign of the cross used his cane to drive himself to his feet, and then limped over and sat closer.
"Do you think you can travel most of the northern route to Val d'Illay in the dark?" Father Ray asked. "No light other than the moon?"
Pino thought, then said, "Not the face of the cirque, but everything up to that, I think."
"How much more time would it add?"
"Maybe an hour. Why?"
Father Ray took a deep breath and said, "I have been praying for an answer to that question, Pino. Part of me wants to keep you in the dark, to keep things simple, focused on your task, and nothing more. But God doesn't make life simple, does he? We cannot say nothing. We cannot do nothing."
Pino was confused. "Father?"
"The three people at dinner tonight. Did you speak with them?"
"No," he said. "But I overheard them say something about Mena."
Father Ray turned somber, pained. 2 weeks ago, there were more than 50 Jews hiding in a hotel in Mena. Colonel Ralph, the Gestapo chief in Milan, sent Nazi SS troops. They found the Jews, bound their wrists and ankles, and threw them into Lake Maggiore, where they were machine-gunned to death."
Pino felt his stomach roll hard. "What? Why?"
"Because they were Jews."
Pino understood that Hitler hated the Jews. He'd even known Italians who didn't like Jews and who said disparaging things about them. But to kill them in cold blood? Simply for their religion? It was beyond barbaric.
"I just don't understand."
"Neither do I, Pino. But it's clear now that the Jews of Italy are in grave danger. I spoke with Cardinal Schuster about it by phone this morning."
Father Ray said the Cardinal told him that after the Mena massacre, the Nazis extorted the Jews still remaining in Rome's ghetto, demanding a payment of 50 kilos of gold in 36 hours in return for their safety. The Jews got the gold from their own stocks and from many Catholics. But after the treasure was delivered, the Germans raided the temple and found a list of every Jew in Rome. The priest stopped, his face tortured, and then said,
"Cardinal Schuster says the Nazis have brought in a special SS team to hunt the Jews on that list."
"And do what?" Pino said.
"Kill them. All of them."
Before that moment, Pino could not have imagined such a thing in the remotest and most troubled parts of his young mind.
"This is evil."
"It is evil," Father Ray said.
"How does Cardinal Schuster know all these things?"
"The Pope," Father Ray said.
"His Holiness told Cardinal Schuster that the German ambassador to the Vatican told him." "Can't the Pope stop it? Tell the world?"
Father Ray looked down, kneading his knuckles white. "The Holy Father and the Vatican are surrounded by tanks and the SS, Pino. For the Pope to speak out now would be suicide and mean the invasion and destruction of Vatican City. But he has spoken in secret to his cardinals. Through them, he has given all Catholics in Italy a verbal order to open their doors to anyone in need of refuge from the Nazis. We are to hide the Jews. And if we can, we are to help them escape."
Pino felt his heart quicken. "Escape to where?"
Father Ray looked up. "Have you ever been to the far end of Val d'Illay, on the other side of the Gropera, beyond the lake?"
"No."
"There is a triangle of thick woods there," the priest said.
For the first 200 meters inside that triangle, the trees and ground are Italian. But then Italy narrows to a point, and the land all around becomes Switzerland. Neutral ground. Safety. Pino saw the trials of the past weeks in a different light, and he felt excited and filled with new purpose. "You want me to guide them, Father?" Pino asked. "The three Jews?"
"Three of God's children whom he loves," Father Ray said.
"Will you help them?"
"Of course. Yes."
The priest put his hand on Pino's shoulder.
"I want you to understand that you will be risking your life. Under the new German rules, helping a Jew is an act of treason and punishable by death. If you are caught, they will likely execute you."
Pino swallowed hard at that, felt shaken inside, but then looked at Father Ray and said, "Aren't you risking your life just by having them here at Casa Alpina?"
"And the boys' lives," the priest said, his face sober. "But we must help all refugees fleeing the Germans. The Pope thinks so. Cardinal Schuster thinks so. And so do I."
"I do too, Father," Pino said, emotional in a way he never had been before, as if he were about to go out and right a great wrong.
"Good," Father Ray said, his eyes glistening. "I had faith you would want to help."
"I do," Pino said, and felt stronger for it. "I better go sleep."
"I'll get you up at 2:15. Brother Bormio will feed you all at 2:30. You'll leave at 3.
Pino left the chapel, believing that he'd entered it as a boy, and now exited it having made the decision to become a man. He was frightened by the penalty for helping the Jews, but he was going to help them anyway. He stood out in front of Casa Alpina before going in, staring to the northeast, across the flank of the Gropera, and understanding that three lives were now his responsibility. That young couple, the smoker, they depended on him for this last stage of their escape.
Pino looked up, past the massive crag of the Gropera silhouetted in the moonlight, to the stars and the black void beyond.
"Dear God," he whispered. "Help me."
Chapter 8 1 Pino was up and dressed 10 minutes before Father Ray came to wake him. Brother Bormio made oatmeal with pine nuts and sugar, and laid out dried meats and cheeses. The smoker and the young couple were already eating when Father Ray came over and put his hands on Pino's shoulders.
"This is your guide, Pino," the priest said. "He knows the way."
"So young," the smoker said. "Is there no one older?"
"Pino is very experienced and very strong in the mountains, especially this mountain," Father Ray said. "I have great faith he'll get you where you want to go. Or you can find another guide. But fair warning, there are some out there who will take your money and then turn you over to the Nazis anyway. Here we wish only that you find safe haven."
"We're going with Pino," the younger man said, and the woman nodded. The older one, the smoker, remained unconvinced. "What are your names?" Pino asked, shaking the younger man's hand.
"Use the names you've been given," Father Ray said. "The ones on your papers." The woman said,
"Maria."
"Ricardo," her husband said.
"Luigi," the smoker said.
Pino sat down and ate with them. Maria was soft-spoken, but funny. Ricardo had been a teacher in Genoa. Luigi traded cigars in Rome. At one point, Pino glanced under the table and saw that though none wore boots, their shoes looked sturdy enough.
Is the way dangerous?
Maria asked. Just do what I tell you and you'll be fine, Pino said. 5 minutes? They nodded. He got up to clear plates. He took them over to Father Ray and said in a soft voice,
Father, wouldn't it be easier for them if I took them up over the Angel's Step into Valdilay?
It would be easier, Father Ray said. But we used that way just a few weeks ago, and I don't want to attract attention.
I don't understand, Pino said. Who used it?
Giovanni Barbareschi, the seminarian, Father Ray said. Just before you came up from Milan, there was another couple here with their daughter trying to escape. Barbareschi and I came up with a plan. He led the family and 20 boys, including Mimo, on an all-day hike over the Angel's Step to Valdilay. They had a picnic between the far end of the lake and the woods. 24 people hiked in, 21 left.
No one would ever know the difference, Pino said appreciatively, especially if they were seeing the group from a long way off.
Father Ray nodded. Those were our thoughts exactly, but it's not practical to send big groups like that, especially with winter coming.
Small is better, Pino said, and then glanced over his shoulder. Father, I can do my best to keep them hidden, but there are a lot of places where we'll have no cover.
Including the entire length of Valdilay, which is what makes this especially dangerous to you, because you'll be coming part of the way back in the wide open. But as long as the Germans keep patrolling the pass roads and don't use planes up high to survey the border, you should be fine.
Father Ray surprised Pino by giving him a hug.
Go with God on your side, my son, every step of the way. Brother Bormio helped hoist the rucksack up onto Pino's back. 4 liters of water, 4 liters of sweet tea, food, rope, topographical map, the anorak, a wool sweater and cap, matches and lint to make a fire in a little steel canister, a small miner's lamp loaded with dry carbide, a knife, a small hatchet. Together the load was 20, maybe 25 kilograms, but Pino had been climbing with weight on his back since the day after he arrived at Casa Alpina. It felt normal, and he supposed Father Ray had wanted it that way. Of course he had wanted it that way. The priest had to have been planning this for weeks.
Let's go, Pino said.
2. The foursome stepped out into a chilly autumn night. The sky was crystal clear, the moon still high into the south, casting a thin light across the western flank of the Gropera. Pino led them down the cart track at first, just to get them away from the gas lamp outside the school. Then he had them stop so their eyes could fully adjust.
We speak in whispers from here on out, Pino said in a hushed voice, and pointed up at the mountain. There are places where noises echo a long way up there, so we want to be timid, quiet as a mouse, you know?
He saw them nod. Luigi lit a match for a cigarette. Pino got upset, then realized he had to take control. He took a big step toward the smoker and hissed,
Put that out! Any flame can be seen for hundreds of meters, more through binoculars.
I need to smoke, Luigi said. It calms me.
Not until I tell you to, or you go back and find another guide, and I take them alone.
Luigi took one last puff, dropped the butt, and crushed it. Lead on, he said in disgust. Pino told them to rely on their peripheral vision as he led them in the low light across the plateau to the north, hugging the base of the slope until it petered out to a path about 50 centimeters wide that cut laterally across several steep faces. He uncoiled the rope and tied 4 waist loops in it with gaps of 3 meters between each loop. Even with the rope, I want you to keep your right hand on the wall or on any bush that grows out of it,
Pino said. If you feel something to grip, like a little sapling, test it before you commit to its holding your weight. Better yet, put your hands and feet where I do. I know it's dark, but you'll get the idea of what I'm doing by my silhouette. I'll follow you, Ricardo said. Maria, you're right behind me.
Are you sure? Maria said. Pino?
Ricardo, you can do more for your wife from the back, with Maria walking third, and Luigi right behind me. That annoyed Ricardo. He raised his voice. But I...
It's safer for her and for all of us if the strongest are at either end of the rope, Pino insisted.
Or do you know more about these mountains and climbing than I do?
Do what he says, Maria said. Strongest at the back and front.
Pino could tell Ricardo was in a quandary, irritated at being ordered around by a 17-year-old, yet flattered at being called the strongest.
Okay, he said. I'll be the anchor.
Perfetto, Pino said, after they'd climbed into the waist loops. He put his gloved right hand on the rock wall and set off. Though the way was wide enough in most places for a normal gait, he imagined the path 15 centimeters narrower to his left and moved tight to the wall. The worst thing that could happen was for one of them to pitch off the low side of the trail. They might get lucky, and the weight of the other three might be enough to hold them all on the mountainside. Or they might get unlucky, and a second person would go, and then a third. The slope below them was nearly 40 degrees. Sharp rock and alpine brush would chew them up if they all started to tumble. He led them at a cat's pace, slinking along, careful, easy, and sure. They moved with little incident for almost an hour, until they were roughly above the village of Madesimo, where Luigi started to hack and to spit. Pino was forced to stop.
Signore, he whispered. I know you can't help it, but cough into the inside of your elbow if you have to. The village is right there below us, and we can't take the chance of being heard by the wrong ears.
The cigar trader whispered.
How much farther?
The distance doesn't matter. Just think about your next step.
500 meters farther on, the slopes they crossed became less sheer, and the trail more moderate.
Is that the worst of it? Luigi asked.
That was the best of it, Pino said.
What?
Maria cried in soft alarm. I'm joking, Pino said. That was the worst of it. 3. By dawn, they were climbing up through the alpine meadows high above Madesimo. The mountain grass that had reminded Pino of Anna's hair was seedless now and dying. Pino looked around behind him and across the valley at the rugged massif rising on the other side. He wondered if there could be German soldiers over there up this high, watching the Gropera through binoculars. Pino thought it unlikely, but he led the three of them off to the side of the meadows where they could climb in the shadows of trees until those gave way to rock and sparse juniper that offered little concealment.
We'll need to move faster now, he said. With the sun behind the peak, there are shadows up in the bowl that will help us. But the sun will be on us soon enough.
Heading into the bowl at the bottom of the North Cirque, Ricardo and Maria kept pace with Pino. Luigi, the smoker, lagged behind, sweat pouring off his face, his chest heaving for thin air. Pino had to go back for him twice as they negotiated fields of glacially cast boulders and stuck to the ancient path to the back wall of the bowl. Pino and the young couple rested and waited for the cigar trader, who was coughing, spitting, and moving at a snail's pace. He reeked of fresh tobacco smoke when he lay down on a flat-topped rock by Pino and moaned. Pino got out sweet tea, dried meat, and bread from his pack. Luigi devoured his meal. So did the young couple. Pino waited until they were done, then ate and drank smaller portions. He'd save some to eat on the way back.
Where now? Luigi asked, as if he'd only just become aware of his surroundings.
Pino gestured at the goat trail that cut a sharp series of steep zigzags up the wall. The man's chin retreated.
I can't climb that.
Sure you can, Pino said. Just do what I do. Luigi threw up his hands.
No, I can't. I won't. You just leave me here. Death is coming for me sooner than later, no matter what I do to stop it.
For a moment, Pino didn't know what to do. Then he said, Who says you're going to die?
The Nazis, the smoker said, hacking, and then gesturing up at the path. And this way says God wants me to die sooner than later. But I will not go up there and fall and bounce over rocks in my last moments. I will sit and smoke and wait for death to come for me here. This spot will do.
No, you're going with us, Pino said.
I'm staying, Luigi said forcefully.
Pino swallowed, said, Father Ray told me to get you to Val di Lei. He's not going to like my leaving you, so you're coming. With me.
You can't make me go, boy, Luigi said.
Yes, I can, Pino said, angry and moving fast toward the man. And I will. He loomed over the smoker, whose eyes widened. Even at 17, Pino was much bigger than Luigi. He could see those facts playing on the cigar trader's face, which contorted in fear when he glanced again at the steep walls of the cirque.
Don't you understand? He said in a defeated tone. I really can't. I have no faith I can make it.
But I do, Pino said, trying to put a growl in his voice.
Please.
No. Pino said. I promise you, you're getting to the top and over into Val di Lei if I have to carry you myself. Luigi appeared convinced by the resolve in Pino's face. With a quivering lip, he said,
Promise?
Promise, Pino said, and shook his hand. He had them rope up again, with Luigi right behind him, followed by Maria and her husband.
You sure I won't fall?
The cigar trader asked, clearly terrified.
I've never done anything remotely like this. I've always lived in Rome.
Pino thought, said, Okay, so you've climbed around in the Roman ruins?
Yes, but how about those steep, narrow steps in the Colosseum?
Luigi nodded.
Many times.
This is no worse than that.
It is.
It isn't, Pino said. Just imagine that you're in the Colosseum and you're cutting back and forth across the seats and steps. You'll be fine. Luigi seemed skeptical, but he did not fight the rope when Pino started up the first leg. Pino kept up a running banter with the smoker, telling him how he was going to let him have 2 cigarettes when he reached the top, and advising him to keep the fingers of his inside hand trailing along the slope as they climbed. Take your time, he said. Look ahead, not down. When the going got rough and the wall turned nearly sheer, Pino distracted Luigi with the story of how he and his brother had survived the first night of bombing in Milan and come home to find music playing.
Your father is a wise man, the cigar trader said. Music, wine, a cigar. The small luxuries of life are how we survive what the mind can't fathom.
You sound like you do a lot of thinking in your shop, Pino said, wiping the sweat from his eyes.
Luigi laughed. A lot of thinking, a lot of talking, a lot of reading. It is...
The joy left his voice. It was my home.
4. They were well up the wall of the cirque now, and the trickiest part of the climb was just ahead,
where the way cut hard right for 2 meters, and then hard left for 3, in a cleft in the face of the slope that dropped away sharply. The challenge was a psychological one, because the trail through the cleft was plenty wide. But the 30 meters of air right there off the trail could rattle even a veteran climber's confidence if looked at too long. Pino decided not to warn them.